love the buildings and the pavement and the malls. I love the factories, I love the rubber balls. I love the ukuleles and the sound of spinning tape. I love the things that people make. I love the tricycles, I love the synagogues. I love the Lego and I love the Lincoln Logs. I love the fishing lures, I love the plumber's snakes. I love the things that people make. Knives, I love the garden gnomes. I love the way that people decorate their homes. I love the ovens and the casseroles they make. I love the things that people make.
Hello, you are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And also, we are syndicated on various stations across the country through the National Campus Radio Association. My name is Sarah Mangle. I'm so happy to be with you this morning. I'm bringing an interview with me today with Allison Mitchell. And I've been talking about this interview with Allison Mitchell for months. I saw her show at the AGO that was in the fall, A Girl's Journey into Forbidden Knowledge. The other title is What Time Does the Labia Close? I thought that was the official title, but it turns out that that was the viral title, and we'll talk about a bit about that in the interview. So Allison Mitchell lives in Toronto, and I'm going to read to you her bio from her website, AllisonMitchell.com, and then we're going to go to the interview. This is part one. There's going to be two parts of this interview, so the second part will air next week. Allison Mitchell is a maximalist artist working predominantly in sculpture, installation, and film. Since 1997, Mitchell has been melding feminism and pop culture to play with contemporary ideas about sexuality, autobiography, and the body, largely through the use of reclaimed textile and abandoned craft. Her work has exhibited in galleries and festivals across Canada, the U.S., Europe, and East Asia. She has also performed extensively with Pretty, Porky, and Pissed Off, a fat performance troupe, as well as publishing both writing and music. She is an assistant professor in the School of Women's Studies at York University. Allison Mitchell's work has been generously supported by the Chalmers Foundation, Canada Council for the Arts, the Ontario and Toronto Arts Councils, and the Scotia Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. You know the premise of the show, These Things That People Make, if you've listened to it before. The premise is anything that people make that is not considered fine art. Now, Allison Mitchell's work is considered fine art. So I'm stretching the rules a little bit because Allison Mitchell's work embraces craft so wholeheartedly and also embraces issues around queerness and feminism that are so important to me. So I made the rule about what we do on the show, and I'm stretching it a little bit because I made the rule. And I'm really excited to stretch it for someone like Allison Mitchell. So with that, we are going to start the interview right now. So this is Allison Mitchell. We met in her home last week. You studied women's studies primarily.
Yeah.
You didn't study studio art.
No.
Like fiber art. I'm so inspired and interested. Like, how did art become the thing that you...
Well, it was, like, in the 90s. I was an undergraduate student in women's studies, and I met a bunch of really cool art-oriented people, and not capital A artists, but just cultural producers, you know? Mm-hmm. And around the same time I got really interested in Riot Girl stuff was just happening, and that was really exciting mm-hmm. to me. And, you know, the whole idea around anyone can produce culture and the politics around making culture rather than just consuming culture was really inspirational to me. And I mean, I didn't even come, my family didn't really have any art background either.
What about craft?
Yes, some craft background. Like my mom was a brownie, owl. And cool. So I actually started brownies at the age of 3 because I went along with my mom to brownies. And I actually often say when I do artist talks that that's where most of my training, my most fundamental training happened in brownie craft circles.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, you know, making those witches and snowmen from the Canadian Tire catalog that you fold the corner, fold the corner, fold the corner, then open it up and it makes this sort of like accordion body, and then you shove a styrofoam ball on top and paper mache, puppets, sewing cards. And I was also really obsessed also as a teenager with jigsaw puzzles, which I would like to count as a kind of craft.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's totally factory made in the same way that a lot of the craft kits that I'm interested in now are, like finding made crafts that people have made, not necessarily unique mm-hmm. artisanal pieces, but from mass produced craft kits. Because
mm-hmm.
I find them really interesting of in terms of a working class, middle class, domestic interior for creativity. That's what a lot of us have had access to. So I value that. And I think even though it's like it can be really beautiful if it's arranged in
mm-hmm.
particular ways. So anyway, yeah, I don't have any training in art. I have brownies.
That's significant.
Childhood obsessions. And then I have Riot Girl.
That's all you need.
You are listening to an interview with Allison Mitchell. That took place last week, and that was just our little intro. So the beginning of Allison Mitchell's history, what brought her to where she is now. We are going to continue that interview now.
So there was brownies, and there was Riot Girl, and
then there was queer community. And there was, for me, I just started volunteering at, like, I volunteered at Buddies in Bad Times, the queer theater. Mm-hmm. I volunteered at the Inside Out, the Lesbian and Gay Film Festival. And through that, not only built a kind of an information, built a bunch of information about what art is and can be outside of, like, a proper gallery space.
Mm-hmm.
But also made really amazing connections with friends and lovers and all that kind of stuff. Those folks are still really my best friends now. Mm. So it was the community thing and people saying, you know, like, you're really interested. It was one of my ex-girlfriends saying, you know, you're really interested in film, so why don't you actually make one? And put a Super 8 camera in my hand and said, make one.
Yeah.
And I did, and it was really fun, and I loved everything that I shot, and I just kind of fell in love with the medium of film, and then also just started, that just opened up floodgates, right, of access and permission to mess around. And I think it's also like Riot Girl and that kind of stuff. The permission was really different, too, because it's not about making something perfect.
Yeah.
It's about process,
it's
just
about
as much.
Doing it.
And also, so, it, you know, it's okay to have, you can see the scotch tape celluloid on the film edits on your Super 8 film, and that's fine. It doesn't have to be this really expensive medium that you pay professionals to help you make.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really helpful to me.
What was the first film you ever made?
I made a really bad film in a workshop. I took a workshop at Liaison of Independent Filmmakers, LIFT, in Toronto. And it was on animation. I was really interested in animation. I've always really loved it. And partly I think it's because of zine stuff and sticker stuff that I was doing, it made sense to go into animation. So I took this 16mm film workshop using one of those big Oxbury cameras that are above, that look down on a platform, it's a professional, but sort of like Russian Cold War machinery.
Very heavy.
Very big and heavy. And I did this experimental video about lesbian bed death called Don't Bug Me. That's 1 minute long. I was just thinking about it the other day and thinking, I'm glad I don't have that on video because it means that it doesn't really get seen very often.
You don't want it to be seen?
Not right now.
Yeah.
But then the first, and I kind of made that the same time I made my first Super 8, which is called Cupcake, that it's easy to see that one, which is it's a kind of a love letter to a chubby girl. It was one of the first fat women I ever met who was just like out about being fat and, you know, just claimed it rather than running from it.
Yeah.
And was very, she was really, just shook up my understanding of, you know, beauty and bodies and stuff like that.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the first installation you ever did?
The first installation, officially or unofficially?
Unofficially.
Unofficially, I think that every space that I've lived in has been an installation.
Mm-hmm.
So my collections, I find ways of putting my materials on the walls and putting my collections out so I can see them. And then sometimes those collections evolve into a sculptural piece or a formal installation. But and sometimes it's just decor. So it's just a way, I'm really into kind of playing with home decoration in that way, which is, you know, makes sense to the kind of installations that I make, which are using home decor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just so, kind of more intentionally. Like
every space that I've lived in. And then when I guess one of the first installations that I did was in my studio at the head studio at the Gladstone Hotel in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And it was really public. It was before and during the renovations that happened to make it into kind of what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
So for about 18 months, I was there Well, I was there for about 4 years, but maybe it was 3 years, but a big chunk of that time, there was nobody else there. And, but when people started coming through to get tours of the hotel or became more public, I would just keep my door open and people would come through. And it was this real kind of living space installation. I had all my stuff on the walls that were things from, you know, a folder with all the birthday cards I've ever gotten to a picture that I'd made to, you know, a collection of flocked covered plastic animals. And so that was another kind of movement into installation. And then when they had their first really big open house, when I was there, I decided to make what I called a Deep Les Craft Den. So I just, which was really just a more formal organizing of my weird collections to, and then calling it a Deep Les Craft Den.
You're really hilarious with words.
Thank you. Like, sometimes.
Deep Les Craft Den is like,
you can picture it.
Yeah, and it's a really good title.
Thank you.
How did it affect your work to be in the Gladstone at that pivotal, at that significant time of change?
Well, it was the first time I ever had a studio, and it was partly because I had gone through this really awful breakup, and then I took off and I went to the Banff Center for the Arts, which was the first kind of formal art thing I did, where it's like, okay, I'm definitely an artist now. I am doing an artist residency at the Banff Center for the Arts.
You're making a serious face, but you're smiling.
Yes. So I took off to, you know, lick my wounds and figure stuff out. And I went there and I was there for 2 months. And then when I came home, I kind of didn't really have a place because it was like a home wrecker sort of situation. Mm. So I took up this space at the Gladstone and I was going to kind of live there. And it was all these things happening at once that made it into a real formal art making setting for me. And it was really great because it was so public and on the TTC line and stuff like that. So I could, people were constantly coming and going. I had crafting events that weren't, it was just like, wasn't even an event. It was just like, come over and let's make some stuff. Or mm-hmm. I was doing a lot of stuff with my performance group, Pretty Porky and Pissed Off at the time. And so we would get together and make costumes or workshop shows, dance practice, because the big hallways that were empty mm-hmm. in the hotel and nothing was happening. So we could use those spaces to do dance practice or make props for performances and things like that.
So it was a really, yeah, it wasn't, in a lot of ways, it was very, it was like not a private.
It was really super public. No, it was not private. And those big, there's big windows, like it was like being in a fishbowl, because there's two windows on the space that I was in. One's south on Queen and the other's west on Dufferin. Mm-hmm. And they're gigantic windows. I used to use them, and so I'd do stuff like paint on the windows to, because I had this almost like a billboard in the city.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd do text that said like, stay, look young, stay fat, stuff like that. Mm. Just to fuck with people's heads.
I was serving coffee, brand new guys. Came up and he said, I know your secret.
You are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3, and that is the Sex Appeals with their song The Fence from a live performance that they did at the House of Handsome in 2010 for a Scorpio party. You are listening to an interview with Allison Mitchell. I call her the Deep Les Craft Superstar. I want to talk to you a little bit about the term Deep Les that Alison Mitchell came up with, and I'm going to read you a statement from her website. She talked about her Deep Les Craft Den that she set up at the Gladstone. So I'm going to read to you the definition of Deep Les, and then we're going to go back to the interview. Deep Les is an experiment, a process, an aesthetic, and a blend of theory and practice. Deep Les is right this minute, and it is rooted in histories and theories that came before. It takes the most relevant and capable ideas and uses them as tools to create new ways of thinking while simultaneously clinging to more radical politics that have already happened but definitely aren't over yet. Part of the deep of Deep Les is about commitment, staying, power, and significance. Part of the deep of Deep Les is about philosophies, theories, and as in wow, man, that's deep. Deep Les uses cafeteria-style mixing of craft content, food, direct action, and human connections to maintain radical dyke politics and resistance strategies. Part quilting bee, part public relations campaign, and part Molotov cocktail, Deep Les seeks to map out the connections between the second-position feminisms that have sustained radical lesbian politics and the current third-wave feminisms that took to unpack many of the concepts upon which those radical politics have been developed. These recent feminisms have set forth a host of important critiques about radical lesbianisms as they have historically unfolded and look to provide correctives in this regard. Unfortunately, this is often accomplished through the wholesale dismissal of radical lesbian practice and identification. Deep Les was coined to acknowledge the urgent need to develop inclusive, liberatory feminisms while examining the strategic benefits of maintaining some components of a radical lesbian theory and practice. This project is carefully situated not to simply hold on to history, but rather to examine how we might call what is useful from lesbian histories to redefine contemporary urban lesbian and queer existence. In doing so, lesbian is resurrected as a potential site of radical identification rather than one of depoliticized apathy, or worse, shame. Deep Les originally began as a cultural project of mine largely informing my art practice. I make lesbian feminist monsters using abandoned domestic handicraft. This has meant the creation of giant 3D Sasquatch ladies and room-sized vagina dentatas. The objects and environments that I create are about articulating some of the ideas and imaginings from second wave feminisms that were so foundational to me while still remaining committed to an inclusive third wave theory and practice. In a short time, the idea grew beyond my own practice and took hold among a variety of local and international communities. For example, the language of deep lies has been adopted by those at the Michigan Women's Festival who lobby for trans inclusion, as well as the organizers of Camp Trans who use an article about deep lies in their annual trans solidarity packages. Here, deep lies is mobilized to move radical lesbianism and identify with or allegiance to trans communities out of the realm of either or and into the space of both and. I recently received word that Deep Les art exhibit is being mounted in San Francisco next year, in which lesbian identification is to be explored as a relevant and strategic site of young queer urban politics. Given the growth of this idea, I am currently undertaking the project of writing a Deep Les manifesto that will begin with a Deep Les I statement. Deep Les is meant to be a point of departure for me to start thinking about my politics and what is important to me and my communities. Deep Les is meant to be a macrame conceptual tangle for people to work through how they integrate art into their politics and how they live their lives and continue to get fired up about ideas. Deep Les can offer alternative ways of imagining the world and who we are. It is meant to be passed hand to hand from crafter to filmmaker to academic to students to teachers to leaders and back again. My wish is that it permeates and loosens things up. Deep Les is not meant to become its own dogma, but to encourage thinking about new feminist and deep and dyke strategic positions. Every Deep Les text, installation, manifesto, and potluck offering is different because it is contingent on the contributions and participation of many, and also because it is accumulating and discarding as it goes. We can band together through Deep Les to imagine and realize our way out of this dysfunctional habitat, to create new ecologies, new policies, and new styles without war, poverty, violence, and waste. Deep Les is the volunteer, the workshop coordinator, the curator, the consumer, the first initiated, and the instigator. Anyone who gets intrigued by the bell-bottomed, fat-assed catch-all, whether they are dykes or not, they are still Deep Les. Signed in solidarity for a new kind of sisterhood that isn't based on gender and privilege and a new kind of brotherhood that isn't based on rape and pillage. So that is Allison Mitchell. That's her Deep Les statement. You can read it for yourself on www.allisonmitchell.com. And now we're going to go to the third part of the interview for today. And once again, I will say that this is the first half of an interview that will be, the second half will come next week at the same time on Thursday at 10 in the morning. And in this part of the interview, we talk about her show, Allison Mitchell's show that recently went up at the Art Gallery of Ontario.
When you are planning something out artistically, what's your relationship to privacy? Like, do you need it?
I'm not a very private person.
Mm.
So, I don't know what you mean.
I guess for some people's practice, like, they don't want people around, you
mm-hmm.
know.
My partner is like that. My girlfriend, yeah. Deirdre Logue, is very private about her stuff.
Yeah.
So I know what you mean. But no, I don't need that. In fact, I always find the more I fling it out there, the more comes back.
Yeah.
So I'm keeping faith in that motto and experience that the more I expose it, keep it open,
mm-hmm.
it's like people get excited, for one. They get caught up in a kind of an idea whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
They offer suggestions that sometimes are really amazing and can, like, get caught up in the whirlwind.
Yeah.
But also means, like, as an artist, if I want to have, like, the ideas that I'm trying to talk about in my art are things I want to hear what people think about them.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have a conversation about it. It's not like a secretive message. Mm-hmm. That's why I try to make the message as open.
Very clear.
Yeah, it's not like art that's trying to make people feel dumb, but trying to make them feel smart.
That's awesome.
So it helps then. I feel like I'm not the world's smartest person.
Yeah.
And it helps me to, you know, just vet stuff, steal ideas, mm-hmm. you know, put it out there and see what other people think.
Tell me about...
I also need a lot of the stuff I make is big scale, so I need help from my friends.
Yeah.
So you got to get a team of people excited about stuff in order to march with you towards that project, or else it would take me way long. I wouldn't be able to do the stuff that I do.
Mm. And you know what? I think often if you say something that you're doing something, then you're actually doing it.
That is totally it too. Mm-hmm. Interpolation.
Is that what
that is? Althusser with something.
Interpolation.
Mm, the idea that if you name it or say it, it makes it come into being. Which was like a lot of the politics around Pretty Porky and Pissed Off were about that too. It's like, say it to try and realize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and it's like, then people are like, so what's going on with that Sasquatch tribe you were talking about? Yeah. It's like, well, it's coming along. Funny you should ask. If you ever need help with that, well, actually, why don't you come on by now?
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so I thought that the AGO show was called What Time Does the Labia Close?
Right.
But...
That was the viral title.
The viral title.
Yeah.
And the other one is...
A girl's Journey into the Well of Forbidden Knowledge.
And that is the official title.
I guess.
A Girl's Journey into the Well of Forbidden Knowledge. Forgotten mm-hmm. Knowledge.
Forbidden.
Forbidden. Do you want to talk about why there's two titles first? Okay.
Well, the title for the show was that, A Girl's Journey into the Well of Forbidden Knowledge, which is actually one of the titles of one of the books that I drew. So I drew a bunch of the books from the shelves of the Lesbian History Archive. Mm-hmm. And one of the book's titles was A Girl's Journey into the Well of Forbidden Knowledge, which made a lot of sense to me, thinking about... I like the way it sounds, because I like the girl part, which, you know, it's not lady, it's not woman. There's something kind of lesbianism is for children about it for me that I like, and queerness is for children. So that part I like, and then also the Well of Forbidden Knowledge plays on the famous Radcliffe Hall book, Well of Loneliness, which for a long time was counted as, well, in a
first
North American-centric context, as the first pop lesbian, not pop, but lesbian fiction that had an out lesbian character. Of course, she was tragic and horrible.
How could she be a lesbian if she wasn't tragic?
Horrible. Depressing. Depressing.
Yeah.
So... I don't know. I think about the Well of Forbidden Knowledge as being, you know, that this place where we all go to drink, to get nourished, to find this information that doesn't necessarily have to be in books. But, you know, I learned how to eat from lesbians. I learned how to take care of my body from queer people. That is the kind of the Well of Forbidden Knowledge that's outside of the heteronormative, sanctioned, understood ideas around what's counted as knowledge and what's important as knowledge, around politics and activism and resistance. That's also in the well of knowledge that's forbidden and erased and forgotten. And it was also about my, you know, it's first person, it's my journey into this lifelong trip into uncovering information that isn't that easy to find. And it's like every once in a while a door gets open and it's like, what? There's all this stuff in here?
Yeah.
Nobody told us that? How could that not even be in the history book?
Yeah. Nope, not there.
Why was there nobody named that in my town?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm talking about. And then as part of the show, they give you a budget at the Art Gallery of Ontario to do advertising. And you can kind of do what you want. And some people do a postcard. And I wanted to do a poster. I wanted to do a poster because I didn't really care that much about the advertising of the show. I more wanted to have an object that people could take with them.
Mm-hmm.
So with that budget, I could make, I don't know, I think it was 3,000 posters. And then 1,500 of them got postered around the city. And I wanted it to be a kind of like a viral title, like play with this idea of... like, when I started doing stuff with Deep Les, it really was meant to be this viral thing, and it became this viral thing where it spread.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought about what time does the labia close comes from when I was in university as an undergrad, and people, like gross dudes as a joke, saying, what time does the labia close about the library, right?
Oh.
Labia, library.
I would have never guessed.
That's okay.
That's so funny.
And so I thought, you know, this is I've created this library, and it's a way of kind of, you know, when people say gross, weird, kind of slightly dirty, I don't know, hearing somebody say labia, it's so gynecological and biological, but it's not a word that you hear very often.
So we're going to stop the interview there, that very interesting point, but I mean, it was all interesting. And we're going to pick it up next week at 10 a.m. Please be sure to tune in. This has been These Things That People Make, and I'm going to give you two websites to check out. So go to Alison Mitchell's website, which is Alison Mitchell, A-L-L-Y-S-O-N, Mitchell, MITCHELL.com, and check out all the work she's done. Incredibly prolific, not surprisingly to me, but just like, it's amazing. So much stuff, so much exciting stuff. And then also check out my blog, thesethingsthatpeoplemake.blogspot.com. And please do be sure to drop me a line if you have any questions, if you want any copies of past shows, sarah.mangle@gmail.com. Have a fabulous week.